This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights about the Maher Arar case.
Although the Canadians settled with Arar, the United States continues its recalcitrance, a recalcitrance upheld, sadly, by a court in New York City.
We'll talk about the deepening economic crisis and where we're headed.
Could this be worse than the Great Depression? Listen and find out.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Michael, tell us what's happening with the military commissions.
Well, as we've tried to update our listeners over the last number of years about Guantanamo, you sort of have to divide the Guantanamo class of people into two classes. One is the people who are not being held pursuant to any charges at all, and of the 300, that's the high majority, 270 or more. And then there's the people who are going to be charged by military commissions, some of whom have been charged. David Hicks, who was my earlier client at the center, was charged but eventually pleaded and got 9 months. He's the only one that's actually gone before a military commission and got out really based on a political deal. Military commissions are these special rump sort of courts that the U.S. has set up in Guantanamo. They've had a lot of trouble getting them started. They've been held unconstitutional, or et cetera, et cetera. They've been rewriting the rules. Last rewrite was in the Military Commission Act. The first trial is going to trial this week, and it's of Omar Khadr. And we've talked about Khadr before. Khadr was 15 when he was picked up in Afghanistan. His father was killed, and they allege that he threw a grenade at a U.S. soldier when this little compound was being attacked. He was wounded, shot a couple times, survived, and was taken to Guantanamo as a 15-year-old. So that, of course, sets off alarm bells. 15-year-olds shouldn't be taken to Guantanamo. They should be, no one should, but they certainly, 15-year-olds should not be, these are child soldiers. They should be treated under a special treaty and basically rehabilitated. But the U.S. didn't take that position. There was also some suppression of evidence as to someone else throwing the grenade. But the biggest news that came out last week was the lawyers in Canada for Khadr released part of a videotape of Khadr's interrogation. The Canadian Supreme Court ordered the Canadian government, even though the guy is being held by the United States in Guantanamo, the Canadian Supreme Court ordered the Canadian government to turn over 7 hours of videotaped interrogation of Omar Khadr. And I watched 7 minutes of it, which is what's on the web now. There'll be more maybe later. But it's just devastating to see it. I mean, if you want to really cry for Khadr and cry for this country, you look at that tape. He's 16 years old at the time. It's 2003. Here's the scenario. He's in a little room. They're videotaping him through a window. Before he is interrogated, he's interrogated by Canadians who Omar Khadr thinks came down to actually help him, to help him get home. And so he thinks the Canadians are there to help him. He's 16 years old, the kid. He's been so-called softened up already by sleep deprivation for many days and what is jokingly referred to as the frequent flyer program. That's where they wake you every 3 hours. They blindfold you and they pretend that they're taking you up on an airplane to some torture country or something, bring you back, put you in another cell, keep you blindfolded. And this went on for days. This is before the Canadians get there. The Canadians know about this. I mean, that's almost for sure. So they're going in to a guy who's essentially been tortured already, certainly treated with cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. 16-year-old boy, father's been killed. He's been isolated and alone. This videotape opens. You can't see it because it's perfectly because it's through slats. And you hear him crying and crying and saying his medical care is terrible and pulling up his shirt and showing where he's still wounded, crying for his mother, just essentially completely broken down. And when he realizes the Canadians are there to interrogate him and not help him, and they're actually make jokes, the interrogator says to him at one point, well, you know, it's better than Canada. At least you have warm weather here. I mean, stuff like that. I mean, really cruel and bad. And you see that, and you see two things. One, that the U.S. is not only holding a child soldier, having tortured the kid, that the Canadians cooperated with him, the Canadians, and they still so far, Harper, who's the Prime Minister of Canada, has refused to really demand Omar Khadr's release. And Omar Khadr, interestingly, is the only person from a Western nation still being held in Guantanamo, and he's a 16, you know, he was 16, now he's 21. That's the first military commission trial to go forward. It's really a complete outrage. Omar Khadr was picked up in Afghanistan. He's a Canadian citizen. His father was essentially acknowledged to be a member of Al-Qaeda and had brought his children with him. And this child at 15 was with his father and may have actually been a child soldier of some sort, or whatever term you want to use, with his father. We don't know. We don't know the answer to that. But he certainly was under the influence of his father when he was 15 and picked up, and his father was killed, I think, in an attack by Americans when they were cleaning out some village in Afghanistan.
Michael, are there any updates on Guantanamo?
Well, you know, there's a lot going on Guantanamo. Basically, the papers are filled now every day. There's the victory we had in the big Supreme Court case, the habeas corpus case, for the Guantanamo detainees, those particularly who aren't facing military commissions, but it applies to military commission people as well. Those cases are now pending in the district court in Washington, D.C., where scores, if not hundreds of lawyers are going forward to try and get those hearings on schedule as quickly as we can. So that's one aspect. While we're doing that at the center and with other lawyers, there's two other cases that are pending before military commissions, the so-called rump sort of military trials that are going to take place in Guantanamo for the U.S. says as many as 80. So far, they haven't had any. The two cases that are pending, one is the Omar Khadr case. And then, of course, we had the incredible decision last week in the El Mari case, which is the U.S. enemy combatant case where a non-citizen, but it would apply to a citizen, was picked up in the United States, charged with initially with some crimes having to do with fraud or something. And then Bush declared him an enemy combatant, where he is laid in custody for 5 years, much of it in solitary. And sadly, the Fourth Circuit, as you will hear from Jonathan Heifetz, upheld his designation as an enemy combatant by a close 5-4 decision. A really sad day for anybody who thinks the rule of law still applies in the United States. Jonathan Heifetz, it's really great to have you on the show. I know last week you received a very rough decision in the El Mari case, which we've been covering here with you. Remind our listeners very briefly what the case concerns and what the decision said.
Well, the case concerns an individual, a 42-year-old man named Ali El Mari, who's a legal resident alien who'd been in the United States with his wife and 5 children studying to get a master's degree, and was arrested and then charged with federal crimes. But before his trial, the government declared him an enemy combatant and has now detained him for more than 5 years without charge. And so the issue, simply put, is whether the president, based on his own say-so, can indefinitely imprison an individual without ever having to present charges against him or try him in a court of law.
Yeah, the issue, in my view, goes to the core of the so-called war on terror and the legality of what the administration has done. And you said it exactly, particularly goes to the core because it's here someone in the United States who's detained, put in solitary, kept as an enemy combatant. This is your second time in the Fourth Circuit on this case. The first time, I know, you won it 2-1, and this time the decision was different. Tell us about what the decision is and what the core holding was.
Yeah, the core holding, it was a very, very narrowly divided decision. It was really 5-4, and it was that the president can, based on the allegations that have been made, Mr. El Mari disputes, based on the allegations that he came to the United States to commit acts of terrorism, he can be held potentially for life as an enemy combatant without charge, and that the war on terror is not just a sort of a metaphor, but it basically is no different than any other war, in that the United States is like a battlefield in Afghanistan, and the president can just use the military to detain people without charge as combatants, just like seizing a combatant on a battlefield. when there were four votes that rejected this and that affirmed that this assertion of executive power contradicts the most basic principles of the Bill of Rights.
It says you have to basically charge them and try them in criminal courts in the United States. You can't simply hold them forever without trial. Is that right?
That's right. It says that terrorism is very serious, but it's a crime. And that means if you're convicted, you can be punished. But it also means that before you're deprived of your liberty, you're entitled to the protections of the Constitution, the right to a trial.
What is just shocking to me is that basically, I remember years ago debating someone at Justice, and they said, we believe that alleged acts of terror can be deemed enemy combatants and held forever. And I just couldn't believe it. I said, in the United States, you believe that? And they said, yes. And that's really what this decision is about. Its core is just it's so shocking. Let me ask you about Timothy McVeigh. This guy, of course, you have a non-citizen here, Al-Mari. According to the indictment, he came into the United States to supposedly, allegedly do an act of terror. Does the holding, would it apply to someone like McVeigh who bombed the Oklahoma Federal Building?
Well, it could. It would certainly apply as all the judges acknowledge to a citizen. I think it could apply in the future to someone like Timothy McVeigh. They did, I think, essentially say that it was limited to individuals with a connection to Al Qaeda. So it wasn't.
It's under the authorization of the statute up by Congress, right?
That's correct. But what it does mean is, as Judge Amat pointed out in her separate opinion, which rejected the government's arguments, that it could, in theory, be applied to another terrorist group or any terrorist group Congress so chose to designate. It was not limited. In fact, what's sort of striking about this is the government has not limited the definition of enemy combatant to Al Qaeda outside the United States. Well, or people seized outside the United States and detained at Guantanamo, for example, includes many people who the government admits have no connection to Al-Qaeda.
I agree that the AUMF, the Authorization to Use Military Force, requires a relationship to Al-Qaeda. And as bad as I think that law is and the way it's been interpreted, the president is certainly outside the United States interpreted to be anybody he believes is planning or involved in a terrorist act against the U.S., Al-Qaeda or not.
Right.
To just reemphasize, the ruling that implies that this can be used against American citizens is really chilling. You can imagine some scenario some years down the line when it's not just Al-Qaeda, but there's some kind of turmoil in this country, who can get picked up and held and for what. It really is the fatal blow against American who are trying to act in a democratic way to do anything here.
That's right.
What's also interesting is, of course, the Civil War cases, which basically said, while your courts are functioning and you're basically a civilian here, you can't do this, right? I mean, isn't that how you read those cases?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a landmark case of called Ex Parte Milligan from the Civil War that says that. And then, of course, there's the other case judges who rule for the government relied on, Ex Parte Kieran, which involved a handful of Nazi saboteurs who were picked up in the United States and tried by a military commission. I think it's a very, very different case and just does not present a much less significant issue. Declared war against another nation, enemy soldiers who just happen to take off their uniforms. It's not a kind of permanent exception to the criminal process for people the president thinks are dangerous.
I think that's exactly right. Well, tell me what's next for you.
Well, we're going to seek review in the United States Supreme Court of the appeals court's decision.
I can't say congratulations other than that you've taken on probably the key issue in the war on terror here. So good luck with it.
Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last month, in the Maher Arar rendition case, where a Canadian citizen was sent to Syria from the U.S. for torture, the Federal Court of Appeals ruled in a 2-1 majority, refusing to hold U.S. authorities accountable for their part in his torture abroad. As Law & Disorder listeners may remember, Maher Arar, a Canadian, was picked up at JFK Airport in 2002, detained in solitary confinement for 2 weeks by the U.S. government, then sent to Syria, where he was interrogated and tortured. Last year, a Canadian Commission of Inquiry cleared Arar of any links to terrorism, and he was given a $10.5 million settlement. Since then, the U.S. has refused to clear his name, and now this majority decision rules that his constitutional claims cannot be heard. Joining us in the studio today is one of his attorneys, Maria LaHood, with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Maria, thank you for joining us on Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
Maria, tell us what the legal case was about.
Maher's case was for his rendition to Syria by U.S. officials. In 2002, in September, he was transiting through JFK Airport in New York from a vacation with his family on his way home to Canada. And he was taken out of line and detained for 2 weeks. His access to counsel was interfered with. He wasn't permitted to go to a court. And then he was put on a jet plane and sent to Syria, where he was tortured and detained for a year.
Can you describe a little bit about what happened to him in Syria?
He was, you know, for the first 2 weeks, he was beaten with an electrical cable. And while he was interrogated for up to 18 hours a day, for 10 months, he was held in an underground grave-like cell, which was 3 feet wide, 7 feet tall, and 6 feet long. It was, you know, it was dark. It was damp. There were rats. There were cats urinating from a little hole in the ceiling. He wasn't allowed to get out at all. He didn't see sunlight for 6 months.
We've covered this a number of times on the show before, but can you give us a little update on what happened in Canada ultimately with his case and where we are in the United States with his case?
Yes. In Canada, after his return, you know, Canadians were outraged that this could happen to a Canadian citizen. So they called for a public inquiry. There was a judge who was appointed who held a 2.5-year public inquiry, reviewed tens of thousands of documents, interviewed numerous government witnesses, and issued a 1,200-page report, not only exonerating Maher, saying he didn't have any links to terrorism or any offense whatsoever, but saying that the Canadian officials had given U.S. officials false and inflammatory information about him. They had basically said he was an Islamic extremist suspected of Al-Qaeda ties. So the government apologized. The government of Canada apologized, and they settled his Canadian lawsuit for about $10 million.
Well, explain what the Canadian government role in his...
Their role was not only giving the United States bad, incorrect information about what he was suspected of and who he was without any caveats whatsoever about how it should be used, or at least without written caveats. But also they didn't act quickly enough to get him out of Syria. And they, after he was released, there were leaks by government officials which also portrayed him negatively and incorrectly. Canadian officials were not found to have in any way acquiesced in his detention in the U.S., or in sending him to Syria. So that $10 million settlement was just for what Canadians had done.
Now, a question on what was the United States' response to his being on some kind of a terrorist list?
Canada had asked for him to be put on a lookout list, basically.
A long time ago.
The same list Ted Kennedy was on, or a similar list?
Unfortunately, we don't know what of the many watch lists people are on, but, you know, it could be. But Maher was not... he was not a mistaken identity. He was just, they had misinformation about who he is and what he had done. At one point, Canada had wanted to interview him as a witness for another suspect. And he had asked for an attorney. The attorney had told the Canadian law enforcement that, yes, he's willing to be interviewed. Let's just have it in my office, and, you know, placed a couple typical restrictions on it, and the Canadian law enforcement just dropped it because it wasn't worth it to them. When the United States knew that Maher was coming in from Zurich into New York, they called up Canada and said, send us that list of questions you want answered. We'll get them answered for you.
After Canada admitted its wrongdoing, apologized, paid the $10 million, was there a request to get him off the U.S. list? Is he still on the list?
Canada has, numerous times asked the United States, you know, up to Prime Minister Harper asking President Bush, he shouldn't be on the watch list. The U.S. had sort of intimated that it somehow had additional information about him that warranted him being on the watch list. But they showed, Chertoff and Gonzalez showed all of that information to a Canadian official. And he said, no, there's nothing new here. He shouldn't be on the watch list.
So your lawsuit was about seeking accountability here in the U.S.
Absolutely. Our lawsuit was against former Attorney General Ashcroft, Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, FBI Director Mueller, and other immigration officials, because they are the people who decided to send Maher to Syria to be tortured.
And what did the lawsuit allege?
Well, it alleged a few different claims. There, first of all, that these officials interfered, violated Maher's constitutional Fifth Amendment due process rights for sending him to Syria to be tortured and arbitrarily detained, and also while he was here in the United States, by his mistreatment and by interfering with his access to counsel and access of the courts. The final claim was a Torture Victim Protection Act claim, which provides liability against people who subject others to torture under color of foreign law, essentially.
And Maria, what's the status of the suit now?
Well, in the lower court, the suit was dismissed 2 years ago in February of 2006, and we appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and it just released its decision last month. And unfortunately, it affirmed the dismissal.
So we don't even have an apology from the United States.
Not at all. No.
When we say affirmed its dismissal, it was actually 2-1, wasn't it?
It was 2-1. So the majority decided that the case could not go forward, but a very strong dissent thought that Maher's case should be allowed to proceed.
Well, tell us about the majority decision first.
Well, actually, just to answer about the apology, although the executive has not apologized and there's been no formal apology, certain members of Congress have held hearings and have apologized to Maher, which really meant a lot to him, and have called on the government to apologize and to compensate. As far as the 2-1 decision in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, they decided that they would not provide a constitutional remedy because of national security and foreign policy concerns. You know, even if national security concerns weren't involved, the court basically said, because immigration law provides a judicial remedy for a review, a judicial review of a removal order, the court here won't accept a remedy for a violation of the Constitution. And it said, okay, we acknowledge it would be perverse because in Maher's case, the government officials actually obstructed his access to a judicial remedy under the immigration law. The court acknowledged that would be perverse if we wouldn't allow a constitutional remedy when the federal officials obstructed the immigration remedy. But even if that's so—
Let me hold you up for a second. When you say the immigration remedy, what I recall is when he had an immigration hearing of some sort, they basically didn't let him have his lawyer there.
He didn't actually have a hearing. What he had was what was essentially a CAT interview, because a
Convention
Against Torture interview. Because he had told the officials that he would be tortured if he were sent to Syria, he had what started at 9:30 on a Sunday night after his lawyer had been called Sunday afternoon at her office, not afternoon, you know, 5 o'clock at her office, and was informed by voicemail, which she didn't receive until Monday, that there was going to be an interrogation that night. She had already informed the officials that she didn't want anyone talking to Maher without her present, of course. So, you know, the officials lied to Maher to get him out of his cell to go to that interview, saying his attorney was there. When he got there, he said, "Where's my attorney?" They said he didn't want to come. His lawyer was a she. For 6 hours until 2:30 in the morning, they questioned him about his fears of being sent to Syria. Repeatedly, he requested his attorney be there. Repeatedly, they lied to him. Repeatedly, he said he would be tortured if sent to Syria. The next day, his lawyer got the message at work, tried to find out where he was, when it was. She assumed it was on a Monday night, this interview. The officials lied to his attorney that day and said he had already been sent to New Jersey when he was still in Brooklyn. Within 24 hours, he was put on a jet plane and sent to Jordan and then taken to Syria.
So let's go back to the circuit now. So we're in the circuit. The circuit is saying his normal remedy would be,
when somebody gets a removal order, they can petition the Court of Appeals for review of that removal order. So if he had a fear of being sent to torture, which he did, which he expressed, he could get the court to intervene and to stop him from being sent to Syria to be tortured. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, he had that remedy. And even if the officials foreclosed that remedy by lying to him and by spiriting him away to Jordan on a jet plane, his only remedy then would be the due process violation, not the underlying claim of being sent to Syria to be tortured. The due process claim is his denial of access to counsel in the courts. With that, the court said, he doesn't have a constitutional right to assistance of counsel. Even though there are regulations providing that he gets a list of attorneys, even though there was some, you know, at least appearance of communicating with, you know, attorney and purportedly trying to invite the attorney, although that was a sham, because he was an unadmitted alien, this is an immigration fiction essentially, because he was not actually allowed into the United States, even though officials had brought him into Brooklyn for 2 weeks, he had no constitutional rights to assistance of counsel.
So because he did not go to customs officials with his passport, get it stamped, and
well, he did,
through.
You know, he went through immigration, but they denied him entry, you know, because even though he didn't want to come into the United States, he wanted to go home to Canada, There is a fiction that he was seeking admission into the United States. They denied him admission into the United States. By denying him admission, they also deny him all constitutional rights to have an attorney, so the court says.
Let me see if I get this. So what you're saying is he comes to the border, they don't admit him. So at that point, the circuit is saying he has no constitutional rights because he was not admitted into the United States. His only right that he had was to appeal being sent to Syria. They denied him that right, but he still might be able to claim that there was some kind of a due process right, but there isn't.
As far as having a constitutional right to assistance of counsel, the court said he had none. We also claimed that he was mistreated and that his treatment here was to sort of soften him up for interrogation and to also make it impossible, really, for him to access counsel in the courts. The court found there that he may have some constitutional due process right, at least one, to not be grossly physically abused, but that the allegations weren't sufficient. As far as not having a constitutional right to access counsel, they said, keeping in mind that, yes, he has a right to petition the Court of Appeals to review his removal order, he also has a right to bring a habeas corpus petition to challenge his detention. But even with those rights, he has no right to have, and I'm not talking about appointed counsel. I'm not talking about asking the government to appoint him counsel. I'm talking about he was able to obtain a lawyer through one phone call that he got, and that all he wanted was the assistance from that lawyer, and he is not entitled to that.
What did the dissenting judge, the lone judge, mm-hmm. say? And then what do you think about the whole process?
Well, the dissenting judge made clear that this, you know, as framed by the majority, this is not an immigration case. You know, he was not an immigrant. He was not trying to come into this country. This is not about immigration. This is about the INS being used to facilitate sending him to Syria to be tortured, to be interrogated under torture. And he was pulled aside when he first came into this country and interrogated, not about his interest in being in this country, but about suspected links to terrorism. So this was an interrogation case. That puts aside all of this immigration concern. As far as national security and foreign policy, those are concerns that are not dealt with at the beginning of a case when we've just made our allegations. If there are legitimate concerns about national security and information coming out that could harm our national security, those are easily dealt with in the process of discovery, in the process of summary judgment, hopefully in the process of trial. That is not a reason to dismiss the case on a motion to dismiss on the pleadings.
At any point was the fact addressed that he wasn't coming from Syria? It's a strange thing that he was coming from, I guess, Tunisia or Tunis specifically into Zurich, mm-hmm. and then from Zurich to JFK and then to Canada. So why not send him to Canada?
Absolutely.
Why not send him back to Zurich? Did the U.S. ever allege that they had sought diplomatic assurances that Maher would not be tortured in Syria as he it's so feared?
It's interesting. Different officials have claimed to receive diplomatic assurances that they relied on. The Department of Homeland Security Inspector General recently released a report in which he said that, first of all, he did not call them diplomatic assurances. It was clear that they were not diplomatic.
What are diplomatic assurances?
Diplomatic assurances would go through the State Department. It would be where the State Department would communicate with probably the Foreign Affairs, you know, ministry of another state, and generally they're understood to be written assurances that whoever is being detained will not be mistreated, will not be tortured. Here we have so-called assurances, which might have come via the CIA. It's not clear. The Inspector General looked at them and said these assurances were ambiguous, were as to the source and authority to protect Maher, and it seems like nobody actually did a review of them. And the interesting thing the IG also said was that the decision to send Maher to Syria was taken before the INS got these so-called assurances, before Maher had his interview under the Convention Against Torture, and before any decision was made actually by INS about whether or not he would be tortured.
Yeah.
And there's no indication here that any assurances were even written. You know, they could have been and were likely just verbal assurances.
You lost 2-1. What are you going to do?
Well, our options are to petition the Second Circuit for rehearing or to petition for cert in the Supreme Court. So we're reviewing those. I guess we're hopeful that if the Second Circuit the full Second Circuit were to rehear this, that maybe we would get a different decision.
Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights, attorney for Meher Arar, we wish you the best of luck, and we'll be following this case.
Thanks
Come
for
back.
Being on Law and Disorder.
Yes. Yes, thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
For many, the recent economic downturn could be a rough patch to a full collapse as a financial crisis hits the nation's markets. Add in that the United States is 9 months into a significant acceleration in energy and food prices. The distressful interaction is known as a scissors crisis among economists. Where is this heading, and what laws or policies can be used to protect us from financial ruin? We start with these questions today in our interview with two guests: Rick Wolf, professor of economics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and Max Frade-Wolf, freelance researcher, strategist, and writer in the areas of international finance and macroeconomics. We will also discuss the economic subgenres, such as new energy technology and housing markets.
Professor Rick Wolf, Max Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
Gentlemen, what's your opinion of the current economic situation, say, vis-a-vis the problems in the 70s or going all the way back to the Great Depression of the 30s? Where are we at today?
Well, I might not have been willing to say this even as recently as a few weeks ago, but it is now clear in mid-July 2008 that we are in the worst economic downturn in the American economy since the Great Depression. The only questions now are just how bad will it get and just how long will it last. But the collection of diverse economic and also political problems that are coming together is a kind of economic tsunami, with this difference that the people on the beach are still partying, and most of those in this society in the United States seem unable or unwilling to come to terms with the scope of the economic downturn and the enormous implications it'll have for politics, for government behavior, for policy, for all of our lives.
Rick, I want to go into some of those details, but before I do that, Max, do you agree with your father about this?
Largely. I mean, I think it's hard to know that I think we're headed in, would be the correction I made, to what looks like the worst economic downturn. We're not in it yet, which might be part of the reason that you have really, really epically low consumer sentiment reading. So there is some.
What does that mean?
In other words, we're seeing the lowest overall assessment of where is the economy now and where is it going to be in a year in consumer polling from the University of Michigan and the leading economic indicators that we've seen in at least a generation. We're seeing the worst housing market performance, bar none, since the Depression, and there actually may already be worse than the Depression. And there is a problem with this because the metrics and measures that we have now that everyone debates to see how healthy the economy is were largely a response to the Great Depression, and the idea that we need to keep a better eye on the economy and trace and track more statistics so that we can see where it is better and hopefully prevent exactly the kind of situation that looks likely to be emerging. So I wouldn't disagree with the forecast, but I don't think that we're in that deep yet. What's becoming clear is that it looks extremely and increasingly likely that that is where we are going.
Now, Rick, do you think we're actually in it now?
Yeah, I am now persuaded that the number of indicators we're seeing, those that Max mentioned, but also that the inflationary rate in the month of June 2008 was 1.1%, and that over the last 12 months, prices have risen 5%. You put these numbers together, ask yourself how many people saw an increase in their income of 5 or more percent. If your increase, like mine, for example, as a professor, was 3% over the last 12 months, then I'm 2% behind today where I was a year ago. And a 1.1% June inflation rate, if it's even roughly kept going for the next year, we're talking better than 10% rate of inflation if it keeps up.
When was the last time we had that?
Not for a long, long time, back in the 1970s. And I think that with a weak labor movement and a bad job market, people's wages are not going to go up 10%. So you're looking at an inflation and a wage relationship that puts the squeeze on the American consumer on top of the falling value of the number one asset that most Americans have, if they have anything, which is their home. This is a very serious economic downturn that is building. Max may be right that it isn't quite here yet, but enough signs are there, which is why this New York Times talks about gloom in the capital and why more and more of the economic experts that I read are changing from it could be to now it's likely to be. If not, we're already in it.
And Max, is that you share that analysis?
Yeah, I'd
here?
Say that I don't think that the rerunning the New Deal is all that likely. I mean, I think that
even
that's
that, right.
several
even
standard that, deviations right. away from anything I could imagine.
I think
seeing.
You're right. I agree.
So
with
it. I think you make a decision about whether you try to burn out the fire with gasoline or you try to contain it. My guess is you try to gas it up, burn it out, and start again.
How are they going to do that? What does that mean literally?
It seems more likely to me.
What does that literally mean?
Okay, so let's look at an absolutely cataclysmic event for the last 2 weeks, which has garnered scant attention and should have garnered a lot, which is the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac
situation. Tell our listeners what that is.
Think of them as the American dream machine. They're two giant, initially public, in the 70s and 80s, privatized institutions that borrow money cheaper than others because they have an implicit and now an explicit government guarantee. And they're in the business of making home mortgages and buying home mortgages to make more and cheaper home loans available to more and less affluent Americans, people who might have trouble or actually basically never be able to own a house if their ability to buy a house was left to the profit-seeking motives of the private market system. So you set them up. They get bigger and bigger and bigger as trying to keep Americans in their houses becomes harder and harder because their wages don't support it, and there's enough debt out there that the house prices get bid up. I'm obviously skipping over decades here, so this is broad brush, but we get ourselves to the present situation. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are wholly insolvent. Not to toot my own horn, but a lot of us were writing articles about that 9 months ago. Why that hit the fan so much in the last few weeks has to do with perceptions and when people are ready to take a look at stuff. But the understanding that these institutions are broke is now very much in evidence. If you look at their share prices, they've declined on average this year 88%. Not a great performance. So you can see that the share prices are in a bit of trouble. They now back 5.2 to 5.3, depending on whose estimates you like best. Somewhere between 5.2 and 5.4 trillion, with a T, trillion, that's $1,000 billion worth of home mortgages. So they are literally way too big to fail and way too big to bail. You can't bail them out and you can't let them fail. And this is a little bit increasingly a problem here. So where do you turn in this scenario? On some level, could you bail them out? Yes. On some level, there are people in the marketplace who overdo the downside because they're shorting the shares. But the troubles are very significant. If you have $80 billion in capital, in the case of the larger institution, and that's backing a little over $2 trillion worth of home mortgages, given the state that the U.S. home market's in, given what's happening in home prices, and given what's happening in delinquencies and defaults, this is not a secure or ideal situation. However, were you to take their debt, I mean, obviously you'd never have to take all of it, but were you to take their debt onto the federal government book, just to give you an idea, it would be in a one-shot deal, the $5 trillion is equal to the entire U.S. debt accumulated between 1783 and 2001.
Wow, that's amazing.
And you'd
amazing
be taking
figure.
It on in one shot, and, you know, That'd be quite a shot.
Right.
If you let them flounder, or even if you let them bump along as a shadow of their former selves, then there will be a lot less money available to a lot more Americans to buy a lot more homes, particularly lower cost homes. And what that would, I would say, do is knock another 20% off the value, probably in short order, to the housing stock of middle-class homes, which have already lost 15% of their value, and absent that, will lose another 15%. And just to think of it another way, you're talking $3, $4, $5 trillion in destroyed middle-class American wealth.
That's really a dire...
Or a quarter of the total wealth of the American middle class.
It's a dire scenario.
Yes, I mean, this is a big deal.
It would mean tens of millions of Americans would be in the likely position of owing to the banks and others on their mortgages a sum of money significantly larger than the value of the house on which that mortgage is based.
Sure. Okay. Right now in the market, in homes under $600,000, which is a modest to, you know, almost not modest, but not the high end for homes. These numbers are always weird sitting in New York where the house prices are different. But these are national averages.
Oh, those
right?
are big numbers
so
for
they
most
skew.
People.
Yeah. About 10% are what they consider short sale target homes. That means that they already 10% of the American housing stock under $600,000, those homeowners are already in a situation where they would need special short sale provision from the bank because they already owe more than the market value estimator on their house. And this is actually in an environment where house prices are continuously falling, so they're getting further and further out of the money on that home.
How does this tie in with the tremendous amount of money that the United States spends annually to keep up its war in Iraq, its war in Afghanistan, the 700 and some military bases it has in some 130 countries around the world? How can they conceive of bailing out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and at the same time sustain the empire?
Well, you always have to be a little bit careful here. On the one hand, sure, you can think that if money that the government is short of were to be freed up by ending the war in Iraq, that would then be available to the classic argument to help things here at home. The problem is the war spending is spending for a war that's over there, but almost all of that money comes back into the United States as payment for goods and services produced here. And there are a lot of industries, including a lot of states with a lot of senators and congressmen and women, who depend on those orders from the federal government to maintain and produce a war, which uses, you know, a war is a wonderful thing. I mean, you buy a gun and then you shoot it and it melts and you got to buy another one. And you buy a cartridge and then you shoot it off into the trees and then you need another cartridge and another airplane and another construction contract for a huge base. It's not so quick. What would happen if the government actually did, just I'm not saying you argued that, but to be simple about it, if you stop spending on a war and use that money to bail out finances, that has enormous and very difficult consequences on the American economy at a time when it has very little slack to absorb that sort of thing. So,
plus, isn't it so that the figures on the war, while they're big, are really pale in comparison to things like what we could do if we had a different tax system? I mean, the numbers aren't that big in terms of bailing out the economy, apart from the point you're making.
Depends. There's a huge range estimate. We've already spent a minimum of appropriated money in the range of $840 to $910 billion.
Oh, well, that's a lot.
By any
to the $1 trillion.
If you benchmark things,
then you're talking about a lot
right,
of money.
I mean, if you want to make something look small in economics, you hold it up to the largest thing possible right. and compare it. The largest right. thing possible is the GDP.
Right.
So you get things as a percentage of GDP. They look smaller. And that's also over a bunch of years. And by the way, those numbers are what they call GWAT spending. That's how the government right. does it, which is Global War on Terror. And that includes Afghanistan, Global yeah. War on Terror activity in Iraq.
Right.
But not the classified portions of the budget. We haven't seen those.
But so Rick's point is, more. I think, Rick's point is really the point. Mm-hmm. If we cut off the war, we'd have to figure out how to keep that domestic production going.
Economists refer to this as military Keynesianism. In other words, right. instead of the government coming in to stimulate the economy by building homes and hospitals and daycare centers and roads, which is what we kind of remember from the Great Depression, this is another way of stimulating the economy by buying endless amounts of military equipment and everything that goes with the pursuit of a war. But it's a very big stimulus. And to cut that off for the peculiar economy that we have raises a whole set of problems that would have to be dealt with at a time of already economic difficulty.
But, Rick and
Even
Max,
though Iraq
isn't it?
Is a bad idea, the value of the U.S. military to this country is rising, not falling. Right. With an economy weakening, the world is a bad neighborhood, and we have a lot of people who are not looking to help us out around the world right now, whether it's because of past misadventures, what have you, right? Financial dominance was one of the things that kept America afloat. The trouble in our leading industry here of finance has strategically weakened the United States and undermined its position in a tough world. This leaves the military, in some cases, as an unrivaled foot that we have to step forward with. And I would assume that the U.S. military's importance would not shrink but might grow. And we also have two leading candidates whose only dispute with each other is how much they'll increase spending to one war or another. That is the only fight between Obama and, other than the bumper sticker and sort of nutcase deluded fans of the various groups, the only fight between these people is which war do they like better and which more war will they increase funding on faster versus the other war.
That's right, Obama wants to increase Afghanistan.
And bomb Pakistan.
And McCain wants to continue fighting Iraq in a big way.
Let me ask you, how do you see going forward, let's say the next year? We have unemployment figures, and I know they're always very subject to debate, et cetera, because of who they count, but they're, 5.5% or so.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that kind of thing? How do you see foreclosures, bankruptcies, food prices, those issues that affect 300 million Americans?
For personal, foreclosures are going to rise by every forecast, pretty much. If you mean corporate foreclosure or corporate real estate markets?
Really personal, I'm talking about.
Personal is going to rise. Probably it'll average across 2008. We'll probably see at least 2.5 million households enter the foreclosure process. If they don't, that will be because late in the year, and we're already halfway through it, some sort of measure was taken that hasn't been significantly proposed thus far to slow this process. A lot of what's passed itself off as assistance or management has really been delay and stalling, which is stretching out this downturn by stalling how fast it moves, which I'm not sure is a good thing, but it does soften the pain right this second and stretch out the slide downward. But there's going to be a lot more foreclosure. There's going to be a whole lot more bankruptcy. We're going to see a round of small and mid-sized regional banks go under in the next 3 months, which is part of what's been panicking Wall Street lately, and probably north of 20 or 30 of them. And you could see another couple large institutions. Last Friday, IndyMac out of California went under, and that was the largest bank failure since 1984. And that's probably not the end, but more like the beginning of the small and mid-sized.
Now, that was interesting, just as an aside. We're in New York, where Senator Schumer issued a letter before that bank went under. And the letter said, I don't want to misquote it, but said something about they haven't regulated this bank well enough or something like that. And then immediately afterwards, there was a big rush to the bank for people to take out their deposits. And some people blame Senator Schumer. He said, I'm blaming the regulatory companies. What's the story with that?
Schumer, they have to have someone to blame. They were insolvent. The letter probably wasn't enormously helpful to them in their process. But anyone paying close attention to a company that grew very large, very fast. By the way, it was seeded and started by three former high-level people from Countrywide Financial. I think you may have heard that there were some problems with their business model. IndyMac, which has that name in part to play off as a private sector alternative to Fannie and Freddie, was specialized in something that they call officially Alt-A loans, and that if you did research in the financial industry for the bundled products, CDO, the CMOs, we referred to, at least among each other for the last several years, as liar loans. These were sort of famous home mortgage loans because they were an innovative product and they were very popular for a while. You do not need to verify your income on an Alt-A.
Rick, can you amplify on what Max had to say in terms of what you see is going to happen in the next year?
Yes. In addition to what Max said, let's see how the free market works. If you confront a mass of consumers with a declining value of the only major asset they have, their home, with a shrinkage in the available credit they can call upon, partly because credit is not being extended by squeezed banks, and partly because they are already so in debt they can't get more credit. And finally, you confront them with an inflation that is making the cost of living go up with no possibility really of their wages to go up. You're talking about a mass of consumers, working people, who are going to be unable to buy over the next year or two at the pace they were buying in the past. And the way markets work is if the demand for goods and services starts to shrink because the buyer can't do it, then the producers start to cut back, both here and abroad, since we buy a lot of stuff from abroad. And that's going to produce a global economic slowdown. There's no point in producing goods if you can't sell them. We are the biggest single market in the world. If we are shrinking, if, as has been pointed out, Europe is having its problems, all I can see is an economic downturn coming. And again, as I said at the beginning, the only real question is how bad and how long it will last. But it's going to make all of the other economic problems worse. Remember that as incomes go down, as unemployment goes up, as production shrinks, as houses lose value, all the tax revenues of all the governmental operations, federal, state, and local, are shrunken. The needs for people for government services go up in these difficult times, but the resources the governments have to do that goes down. That's not a good sign either. We're going to have to see a number of governments dealing with fiscal crises that they don't have any clear way to get themselves out of. That's why I said what I said at the beginning, a mounting series of economic phenomena converging to produce a very serious downturn. And when we look, as we often do, what could offset this? What might? There are some things, but they're few, and they don't look too good as having the power to offset this serious economic crisis.
If you two economists, Max Wolf and Rick Wolf, were the program suggesters for a political formation, what kind of demands would you suggest that they make on the government, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats or whoever? But speaking, and I know you guys are independent of these parties, speaking as independents, what kind of demands would you formulate on whoever runs this government to ease the problems for the mass of people who are going to be so badly affected by the disaster that you both so, I think, accurately foresee?
I mean, I think a sort of mild initial, you'd need a massive put people back to work reinvestment program in rebuilding the infrastructure of this country, which is pathetic at this point and keeps us out of competitiveness around the world. You'd probably need a real alternative energy investment for the future of the planet, for the general public, and also to drive our competitiveness as in the future with other places. I think that would be pretty much bare minimum. You'd need an enormous reinvestment in the public education system, which is also, in other words, you'd have to rebuild a civil society and a national bond and national viability. And that would have to mean pulling a lot of money out by taxing corporations at rates that they haven't been taxed in decades and taxing affluent Americans at rates that they haven't been taxed in decades. And if you don't or can't do that, then the rescue operation becomes dubious. That would be the kind of bare minimum first set of things.
And Rick, do you have something to add to that?
No, I think that one way to summarize what Max said is that we've now come off of 30 years or more of cutting back the government's intervention in the economy and reshaping it so it becomes a kind of cheerleading adjunct to an economy shaped and driven by private enterprise and private investment and so on. And so that we now have an economy in which the private sector has made a lot of money, the public sector that it needs to support its activities, including infrastructure, has been let go. And this worked so long as the private was an engine of more and more profits, but that engine just hit a stone wall. And so it now is not able to move the economy forward, and it faces a government that has been ripped apart in terms of its capacity to do that. So you'd need, at the very least, a massive transformation of the priorities and the funding, which I don't frankly see. And then I want to return to my original point. If all we did was that, if we even could do what Max correctly outlined, if it did was done and still left those corporations with the same concentration of who controls the profits and their ability to use those profits, they will once again, for the same reasons they did it before, undo the very reforms that could be put in. So I think that a program has to have two parts. One, the kind of massive intervention Max outlined, but number two, a serious attention to reorganizing the way production is managed in our society, the very units that do it. Otherwise, these reforms, even if achieved, will be undone by the same forces that undid them this time.
It's a wildfire argument, right? I mean, you can put out the California fires so that the houses on the cliffs don't burn to the ground. But if you don't change something sort of fundamental to the lay of the land and the underbrush and the fire hazard, then you are just waiting for the next lightning strike to burn it out again, right? And so you have two issues.
Where can they continue this conversation with both Max Wolf and Rick Wolf?
I write for the Asia Times, which is atimes.com, seekingalpha.com, well, that tends to be a little more technical, The Prudent Bear, and Huffington Post.
And Rick?
I write mostly for the, on a regular basis, for the monthly review website, about once a month, recent one about a week ago that goes into some of the things we talked about today. And I also teach here in the New York area for your listeners, both at the Brecht Forum and occasionally at the New School.
Max Wolf, Rick Wolf, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for
the second time, and I hope there'll be many more times.
Okay. Thank you, guys. It was great and pessimistic.
Okay. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And one more thing, Rick. Can you lend me $10 till Friday?
Sure. Interest rate, 12%.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.